We put in next at the floating island of Aeolia, where King Aeolus of the Winds gave us the most glorious welcome. Aeolus lives more like a god than a king, a fashion far different from that which we endured in the cave of Polyphemus or amongst those dreamy lotus eaters. We stayed for a month, and every single day huge feasts were spread out in the hall. In the evenings, King Aeolus would lean back on deep feather cushions and listen to my tales of the wonder and wickedness of war, rather as you are now, although I think your cushions, King Alcinous, are a more manly horsehair. Musicians played, and at night we all slept in soft beds under the same great roof. This was a manner of living not only different from the islands we had recently visited, but a world away from my household in Ithaca, too. After 4 weeks of this lavish hospitality, I feared my men and I would grow soft and fat. Perhaps this was not so very different from the lotus eaters, after all. Aeolus has 6 sons and 6 daughters. I was a little surprised to learn that they are all married to each other, with his permission, apparently, or perhaps even under his direction. I never quite found out which, nor did I discover if they shared the same mother. Not for me to question the customs of others. Aeolus's current queen is the loveliest nymph, rumoured to have served until recently in the personal retinue of the goddess Hera. It was a warm and fond farewell. He pressed into my hand the most marvellous gift, a leather bag, tightly tied with a silver knot, into which he told me he had trapped the winds. He placed this in the hold of my ship and wished us all safe passage home. For 9 days and 9 nights we sailed. Aeolus had set the west wind, Zephyrus, to blow us gently homeward. This reference to a west wind has provoked much interest in those who wish to place, not just Aeolia, but Ithaca itself. Is Homer's Ithaca the Ithaca we can visit today? If a west wind took one there from Aeolia, where could that island be? It's not a game I am good at, but for some it's a happy life's work. On the 10th day, we sighted Ithaca. In the far distance, I made out trails of smoke rising from the beloved Mauve Hills, and knew that at last, I was home. All the terrors, burdens, anxieties, and agonies of command that had besieged me since, in truth, since I could not tell when, fell from me now as the outline of my dear home island grew and grew on the horizon. I leaned back with a smile, finally at peace. Tensions in me relaxed, and I fell into a deep sleep. Dear gods, how I was to pay for those 20 minutes of rest. As I slept, the crew began to mutter and grumble. Oh, it's fine for Lord Odysseus. He's the guest of honour, praised and pampered wherever he goes.
Did you see what Aeolus presented him with? That oxide bag. Wonder what's in it.
The silver drawstrings must be worth a fortune on their own.
But can you imagine what's inside? Gold and pearls. Jewels.
Why should he keep them all to himself? We fought alongside him.
We risked our lives just as much as he did.
More.
In a few hours, he'll step onto the quay and order all his treasure to be carted over to his palace.
He strides off rich and royal. We trail back to our shacks.
Probably find some man living there with our wives. It's not fair.
We can at least look inside the bag, share out some of the spoils.
We'll leave most of it behind for him.
Where's the harm in that?
Just take our fair share.
They crept down to the hold and brought the bag up on deck. 4 men took a drawstring each and pulled.
The winds blew out in a screaming hurricane. The men were thrown backwards and almost overboard, as our ship and the 11 others of the fleet were tossed around like leaves in a tornado. I awoke face down on the deck. There followed a nightmare of pitching and tossing. The tiller could do nothing. The oars, had they been tried, would have snapped like celery. All we could do was let that screeching cyclone take us where it would. At last it seemed to ease, and one of the men yelled with excitement that he could see land ahead. Perhaps the whirlwind had spun us in a circle, and we were back at Ithaca. But no. The winds, like prime horses that know their way home, had pushed us all the way back to Aeolia. We put in, and I sheepishly made my way to the court of King Aeolus. He was, of course, astonished to see me.
"Why, man, I thought you would be in Ithaca, and at your own fireside by now. Never met a fellow keener to reach home. Why return?"
"Great king, the malice of Hypnos and Eris," I began. "The gods of sleep and discord, respectively, and offspring of the primordial darkness Erebus and night Nyx. But something in Aeolus's demeanour told me that this kind of pompous poetic explanation would not go down well. "Sir, the fact is, I fell asleep, and my treacherous, despicable men—" He heard me, arms folded, eyes cold. After a terrible pause, he raised his arm towards the sea and slowly extended a finger.
"Get out. I don't know what you've done to offend the gods, but it's clear they hate you. I know better than to offend them. You'll get no more help from me. Go."
I turned and trudged in silence out of his hall, my face aflame with humiliation. And now we had to contend with a windless world. The men, in sullen despair, plied the oars for 6 whole days. They knew that on this occasion it was not my curiosity that had caused this disaster, but their own, which made every stroke of the oars harder and heavier. On the 7th day, we reached the island of the Laestrygonians. Have you heard of them? I had heard rumours that they were gigantic, that they ate human flesh. I used to laugh at rumours like that. Travellers' tales, designed to tickle and terrify children, I always thought. But after what we had suffered at the hands of the Cyclops, I was prepared to believe anything. The fleet headed to the cliff-fringed harbour town of Telepylus, founded, they say, by Lemos, another child of Poseidon. As it happened, my ship was the rearmost of the fleet. The 11 ships ahead steered in a line into Telepylus. The harbour lies between 2 rows of sheer cliffs. The water of the strait is calm and still. There was no room for my vessel, the last in the line, so I moored and tied up in a small bay on the shore. A tender, with a landing party of 6, left the foremost ship, which was anchored in the calm of the harbour. I watched as the craft beached and the men scrambled out. I lost sight of them. 5 minutes passed. Suddenly, 2 of the men burst into view and threw themselves into the tender. As they struggled to ship the oars, an enormous boulder dropped out of the sky and crushed them. The most enormous creature, half as big again as Polyphemus, strode out, plucked them from the boat, and swallowed them whole. Eurylochus, by my side, touched my shoulder and pointed with a trembling hand. All along the headland, the outlines of enormous giants were appearing. They had raised above their heads rocks the size of small houses, and began to throw them down into the 11 ships of the line, smashing them to pieces. Far back as we were, I could hear the wrenching and splintering of wood and the screaming of my poor comrades. Next, the giants started to shoot arrows and throw javelins, spearing the men like fish. And soon they were leaning down in the manner of buyers at a market to pick up their meat and carry it away, to cure and cook and eat later, I supposed. I realized the danger my ship was in. I unsheathed my sword and slashed the mooring cables. "Row!" I shouted to my crew. "Row for your damned lives!" The men needed no further urging. They set themselves to their rowing stations, pulled hard at the oars, and we shot away faster than crocodiles on the Nile. But of those 11 ships we left behind, not a man was left alive. Nearly 500 good Ithacans had managed to survive not only the most terrible war in man's history, but the wrath of the vengeful Cicones, the seductions of the Lotus Eaters, the murderous ferocity of the Cyclopes, and the worst storms that the gods had ever hurled at humans. But their luck had run out, and they had been butchered without mercy, food for the savage Laestrygonians. Our whole proud fleet was now reduced to one ship of just 38 souls, plus Eurylochus and me. Once we were safely out to sea, the men fell forward to rest on their oars, gasping for breath. I could feel their eyes turn on me, and I wondered if Polyphemus's curse ran in their ears as it was running in mine. May Odysseus never find passage home, or if the fates decree that he must return to his family, may he do so only after years of torment and misery, alone with all his treasure, companions, and ships lost. I hailed the puff of breeze that now came as a sign that the gods were at last favouring us. We hoisted sail and let that wind take us where it would. It took us to... Odysseus turned to take a fresh cup of wine from the steward who had stood behind him throughout the long recitation of his adventures. King Alcinous and Queen Arete were in the same attitude on their couches. The nobles in the hall were leaning forward. The serving girls, pages, and stewards lining the walls were as still as statues. "It is late," said Odysseus apologetically, "and I've been talking and talking. Perhaps you've heard enough?"
"Sir, if you have the energy and the disposition, we could listen to you until cockcrow and beyond," said King Alcinous. A murmur of assent filled the hall. Odysseus drained the cup, set it down, and cleared his throat.